The Tom Woods Show, episode 2086.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you enjoy the Tom Woods Show, it's time to go to the next level. And next level, Tom Woods, is libertyclassroom.com. This is where my friends and I teach all the stuff you did not get in your conventional education, history, economics, and more, the way it ought to be taught, with all the content they left out or distorted. Check it out at libertyclassroom.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. I'm doing something a little different I've never done before. Most of you probably know I have a website, libertyclassroom.com, where we have a whole bunch of courses on all different topics, and it's taught the way it ought to be, rather than the way you probably got them. And one of the benefits we give to people, we have three different membership tiers, and in the top two of the three membership tiers, one of the benefits is, in addition to the courses, we also have a live Q&A session with one of our faculty members every month. And this month, the faculty member in question was Jeff Herbener, who's the chairman of the economics department at Grove City College, and one of the smartest people I know. In terms of economics, I've been asking him questions for going on, well, almost 30 years, and I have yet to stump him. And he's very, very workmanlike in his style. He's not flashy. He's not loud telling jokes. He's very matter of fact, but my gosh, does he know an enormous amount. And I am very, very glad he's on our side. Well, anyway, I really liked this month's session. I thought the folks who attended asked really great questions. And I think the resulting recording is something that my folks here who listen to the Tom Woods Show might actually enjoy hearing. People asked all kinds of questions on economics, everything from the current situation to COVID to theoretical questions about economics, business cycles. It's all in there, and I think you guys will enjoy it. So with that, here we go. Hello, everybody. I'm here with our friend Jeff Herbener from Grove City College, who is sitting in his academic office, and you can see behind him on the top of his shelf, Bavarck, the economist. Is that Frederick Bastiat next to him?
That's Bastiat, and that's J.B. Say.
J.B. Say, right. So all three of them, 19th century economists. Although, I guess Bavarck lived into the 20th century, but was born in the 19th. Yeah. So anyway, we're going to take your questions on economics today, economic-related questions. So let's go right over there. Now, recently, Webinar Jam has streamlined this a bit, and we now have two tabs. We have a chat tab and a Q&A only tab. So that the Q&A only is where I'm going to be getting our questions for tonight. So please post them in there. And with that, let's get going. Okay. So the question, Jeff, has to do with Hans Hoppe's thesis in the book Democracy, the God That Failed. And he was arguing that if you look at the transition from monarchy to democracy in Europe, it was not followed by improvements in economic growth and stuff like that. And so the question is asking, did we see a similar situation in the U.S. before and after Lincoln, or maybe before and after the Democratic election of senators? Or is there any part of U.S. history where we see a similar phenomenon?
Yeah, well, that's interesting. I don't know about the particular transition from less democratic to more democratic, how that would play into it. I haven't thought very much about that, but you remember Hans Hoppe's argument has to do with time preference, that politicians who are just caretakers instead of, so to speak, owners of the assets of the state will move progressively toward higher and higher time preference, toward a more present-oriented decision-making, and that this is what leads to the squashing of economic growth. The policies are distorted toward present deprivations that the state does on the productive part of society. And so that's clearly been happening in the U.S., but I'm not sure about the politics of the less democratic to more democratic transition. I've never really thought about how that's correlated.
Yeah. By the way, we have got some absolutely scorchingly great questions already. So Matt, I'm going to come back to yours in a minute. I want to start with ones that are a little bit more entry level for most people, but I will come back to your question. So Jed asks, some analysts claim that price inflation in the equity, bond, and real estate markets is due to money creation, while consumer price inflation is due to product shortages resulting from lower production and delivery disruptions. Do you agree?
Well, not entirely. We know that price inflation, just like the price of anything, money's price is determined by both supply considerations and demand considerations, or as Rothbard likes to put it, the total stock of money and the total demand to hold money. So that's one issue. So it's a change in that money relation that causes the purchasing power of money to go up or down. So that's a different phenomena from what Jed is talking about in the first part, where he talks about asset price inflation. So anytime you have an increase in the money supply or a change in the money relation, let's say demand for money goes down, you'll get disparate effects on the prices of different things, depending on how people are changing their spending patterns or demand patterns for goods. And so when there's monetary inflation by a central bank through credit expansion in the commercial banking system, we get asset price inflation as the new money goes into the hands of entrepreneurs who start to bid up prices for assets, fixed assets, right, to factories and equipment and so on to build up their capital capacity to produce more. And that will manifest itself typically more obviously than price inflation in consumer goods. So that depends upon what happens when people earn their income and they experience higher incomes, and then how they change their demands for goods relative to changes in their incomes as the process unfolds. Yeah, that's a really good question.
All right. Oh my goodness, we have a bunch. Okay. Gilbert asks, I don't recall economists talking about the danger of having supply lines that cross the globe. Now we see the problem. Was that ever addressed and I missed it?
Well, you know, that's an interesting point. When they talk about supply chain breaks or supply lines, as Gilbert puts it, they're talking mainly about transportation. So they're just talking about shipping or trucking or so on and so forth. So has this ever arrested the attention of economists as a kind of special problem? I would say not really. And it indicates that if we have a free market, this isn't a special problem. It isn't that there's something about transportation across political borders in a system of free trade that presents particular bottlenecks or breakdowns or what have you. Even right now with the supply chain breaks, it's not entirely obvious to those of us who aren't specialists in this area to figure out exactly what the particular problems happen to be. You know, we've heard for a couple of years now about the difficulty at the ports in California and the West Coast. But it isn't really clear exactly what the problem is. Is it that the cargo is offloaded and it's not put on trucks expeditiously? Or is it that there are too many ships that come into the ports and they can't manage the flow of things and so on? Until all of that is known, it's sort of hard to have a robust analysis of all this. But I wouldn't say that this is a problem that economists study, because it just doesn't come up very often.
All right, let's see. How about, what is the ultimate summary of the differences? Now, anybody who thinks this is too technical, just hang on and listen, okay? We got Ludwig von Mises, maybe the best Austrian economist ever. I mean, you can argue this, it doesn't matter, but it's hugely important. Then you have Murray Rothbard, hugely important, but they differed a little bit on monopoly theory. And somebody's asking, how would you summarize the differences in the approach taken by each of them?
Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, the key criticism that Rothbard made of Mises's analysis is that Mises claimed it is possible to distinguish in practice, to look at the world, in other words, and be able to distinguish between a price that is a monopoly price and a price that is a competitive price. And Rothbard's argument about this is that every price that any entrepreneur asks for the sale of the product, the entrepreneur will always ask the price that he or she thinks is at the revenue maximizing point. So there is no way for us to conceptually distinguish, when we look at the world, whether the price being asked is monopolistic or competitive. It always has the same exact character. Now, the reason why this claim by Rothbard bites against Mises is that Mises distinguished between a monopoly price and a competitive price in the kind of standard way in which this is done in the textbooks, which is a monopoly price emerges on the market when a firm is in a position without direct competitors to raise the price of his product higher than it would be under conditions where there was competitive pressure. And that's precisely then the issue that Rothbard points out is not possible for us to apply to real entrepreneurs in the world. We can think of models where this would be the case, but not real events. And to defend Mises' position a little bit, or to elaborate just one more point, I don't want to be misunderstood on this. Mises had a much better theory of monopoly than in the standard neoclassical treatment, because Mises recognized that there can't be monopoly prices of output in the market. There can only be monopoly prices of unique input goods. So like if De Beers controls all the diamond mining in the world, then there could be a monopoly price, he thought, of wholesale, of their selling diamonds to the retailer, even though there could be no monopoly price of retail sales of diamonds, which again, it, for various reasons that maybe we don't need to go into, that's a much better claim than the idea that, you know, entrepreneurs selling at retail who somehow are in a position of monopoly where they can raise their price and earn monopoly profit.
Okay, so this is one I liked right from the start, but I was afraid it might be too technical to start with. How does the Austrian theory of the business cycle apply to today when we don't have a hard commodity standard? It makes sense to me to think of credit expansion beyond the actual money when it's a hard commodity such as gold. But what is credit expansion when everything is just fiat dollars?
Yeah. Well, I guess it's because everything that is a medium of exchange is not fiat dollars. That's the whole argument that Mises makes, right? So that the Austrian business cycle theory depends not on the money proper, whether it's gold or whether it's fiat paper or whether it could be cryptocurrency. It doesn't matter. What matters to the Austrian business cycle theory is claims to money, what Mises calls money substitutes. And if it's possible for banks to increase money substitutes beyond their holding of money, if they can be fractional reserve, then that issue of extra claims to money, like checking account balances, can render the monetary inflation and credit expansion. This, of course, is why you get business cycles in the 19th century in Western Europe and in the US, even though these countries had commodity standards.
I'm going to ask the question, but I want you to, if you wouldn't mind, before answering it, explain to the audience what welfare economics is, because it's not what you think. He says, Professor Herbener, I'm interested in Rothbard's critique of welfare economics, which I guess appears in that one major article that he wrote when he was quite young, actually, that Brian Kaplan criticizes, but incorrectly, according to you. What resources would you recommend on studying welfare economics and its problems, along with the Pareto superiority of free market transactions? Also, what is the current state of welfare economics? So start off by telling us what this is all about. Does it use welfare payments?
Right. Yeah. Welfare economics has to do with what we might call social welfare. That is to say, can we assess any particular configuration of an economy that when it undergoes an alteration, like let's say the government taxes some people and then transfers the money to infrastructure projects. They build roads and so on. And we can clearly see that some people are harmed by this in their subjective preferences, and other people are benefited. And the question of welfare economics is, can we say whether on net there's a social benefit when these kinds of transfer of resource use occurs? And what Rothbard argued was that in order to be scientific in the treatment of this question, the only standard we can repair to is what he called demonstrated preference. And the reason for this is because the only other standard we could repair to would be our own subjective assessment of what happened. But we all could have subjective assessments of, you know, whether people are better off when resources shift one way or another. But as Rothbard argued, this would not be scientific. So we might think it's a good thing that they're, you know, road building, or that, or even that an entrepreneur does something with funds, right? That Elon Musk starts SpaceX or whatever with funding, transferring resources away from another use that also had value to other people and other production. So that's the question of welfare economics. And then when you mentioned the Pareto principle, Pareto tried to deal with this in a model where he talked about how the market would lead to an improvement in social welfare. And as Rothbard plays out on this, right, he undertakes a reformulation of all this. He accepts that principle where we can show through demonstrated preference that in a voluntary trade, there's mutual benefit. And so since the traders gain and other people don't lose with respect to that trade, then we could say that, so to speak, social welfare goes up, right? There are at least some winners and no losers in preference in those kind of normal market activities. And then this whole framework can be extended to talk about, it got extended to talk about acquisition of resources. So that would also have to enter into welfare economics. And there Rothbard invokes his natural rights or Lockean view of how people come to acquire resources. And so it's the same way, right? If each of us own our own labor and we homestead some landside or natural resource, then those who are doing the homesteading benefit, they're demonstrating their preference for this. And others, by demonstrating their preference by not doing it, have shown that they don't value it more highly. They're not worse off, in other words, if it's done by someone else. Hans Hoppe, again, takes on this particular point. And so you can show, as Rothbard did and Hoppe following him, you can show that the whole process, the unfolding dynamic of the market in the acquisition of resources and then the trading of ownership of claims and so on and so forth, are all Pareto superior. That is to say, at least some people are gaining through these changes, whereas other people who aren't engaged in them are not losing with respect to those interactions, right? The trade of other people. And what Rothbard did additionally, of course, is to show why government intervention then could never be Pareto superior. It could never be the case that if coercive violence is imposed upon people, if taxes are raised in order to pay for the infrastructure project, that you could show that no one is worse off. Someone must always be worse off if there's a coercive imposition that's involved in the transfer of use of resources. And so that was Rothbard's great achievement, right? To show that welfare economics, if properly grounded in these principles, actually demonstrates welfare superiority of a completely private property, free market arrangement in economic activity, and the government involvement in economic activity can never duplicate this. It would always be Pareto inferior, right, to this result. Yeah, welfare economics today is along the lines of this welfare economics that developed with Rothbard and Hoppe and so on, has not gone any farther. Welfare economics, to the sense that it's being practiced today, is almost always just this non-scientific sort of subjective claim about what the researcher thinks is superior. And so it really doesn't have the character of the struggle that economists had with this whole field of welfare economics. It took most of the last 100 years. Well, that's probably not quite right. But this issue came up in the 1930s. Well, even before that, there was the old welfare economics, but this newer branch, you know, started many decades ago, and it took a long time for it to be sort of worked out fully. And you see this again in Hans Hoppe, sort of the culmination of what Rothbard began in welfare economics.
Okay, let's skip ahead to this one, and I'll go back. But Gary North, may he rest in peace, thought the lack of price inflation after QE by the Fed after the 2008 recession was a big problem. What's your opinion? In other words, it's a big problem for us because we should have expected a lot of price inflation. We didn't get it at that time.
Yeah.
And we've come up with various explanations for why that should be, but apparently he didn't buy any of them and thought we had to admit we had a problem. So what do you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think now that we're past the QE episodes, you know, almost 10 years, that we have a better grasp of exactly what was going on. And once you look carefully at the data, it's pretty clear that, as I was pointing out before, that the purchasing power of money depends upon the stock of money and the demand to hold money. And as the stock of money was radically increased by the Fed through the QEs, the demand for money went up not quite commensurately, but pretty close. And quite a bit of this was just in the buildup of excess reserves by the banks. But even beyond that, in the commercial world, there were huge cash holdings that were built up by various businesses. In fact, this became so well known that lefty types would start to criticize these corporations for sitting on these big, gigantic hoards of cash instead of investing them, because even they would grasp the difference between just sitting on these cash balances and starting projects, right? Starting the economic activity going within some particular line of investment. So I think when you put all the data together and look at the balance of these things, you can see pretty clearly that it was this sort of offsetting increase in money demand, people just holding money, that accounts for the fact that the increase in the money supply the Fed was generating did not lead to radical price inflation. By the way, the same thing happened in the 1930s. And a similar thing is happening now. Although right now, that is with the massive inflation that the Fed's engendered during the lockdown, it's almost solely the banks that are holding the excess reserves, building up these cash hoards, in other words, sort of absorbing, in a sense, the overall impact of the monetary inflation. And this is, I think, an adequate explanation. I mean, there may be other factors involved, but this seems to be at least the foundation on which we would build an adequate historical explanation.
Okay. John, we're gonna hold off on the Bob Murphy interest rate controversy until the very end, if we get to it at all. We've covered it before. Let's see. Should the U.S. continue to rely on China for the bulk of pharmaceutical production, or do we just let the free market run its course? Sounds like there's an agenda in this question, Jeff.
Yeah. That's interesting. Well, my first thought is that, of course, we don't have a free market in all of this. This is the problem, right? In trying to analyze any actual historical case, we have to disentangle the effect of government intervention from the market actors, right? They're intertwined, obviously, in real history. And so the fact that pharmaceutical companies are intertwined with the state, and perhaps in ways that we didn't even realize until the vaccine controversy, we can't really assume or assert that this is the free market that's generated this nexus of pharmaceutical production and then the distribution of drugs and so on. So, you know, I'm not sure what in particular, the China connection has to do with it. But again, this is in the mix, right? If there are certain, you know, government relationships like the Wuhan lab between the American federal government and the Chinese government, well, this is hardly the free market giving us this result, right? So we have to think of this as Patrick Newman would, as cronyism, or at least recognize the intertwining of these different elements and try to disentangle them. We don't really know exactly what the pharmaceutical industry would look like in a perfectly free market, but it certainly would look radically different from what it does in our world.
Okay, how about the Cantillon effect? I mean, first explain what it is, and then I think Frank is probably going to be disappointed because I don't know that anybody has the answer to this question. In percentages, how much money has been added to this money supply over the last 2 or 3 years? And of that new money, what percent went first to government agencies?
Yeah. Again, that's a little bit difficult with our public data to get at that precise magnitude. But in any case, we can give a little bit of an assessment of this. So let's start with the Cantillon effects. We mentioned this earlier. Anytime the process of monetary inflation is set in motion, there'll be some participants in the market or in government that will obtain the funds first, and they will begin to buy things then that they prefer. And the prices of those things will be driven up sooner in time than people who earn income from producing the things that are being bought by the first receivers of the money. The income earned there will be spent on another set of goods and so on and so forth. And so the process of increasing prices that's set in motion by an increase in the money supply is uneven, both in time and in extent. So the prices of some things go up to a greater extent than the prices of others. We mentioned this in asset price inflation before. And the prices of some things will go up earlier and the prices of other things will go up later. And so this redistributes income and wealth throughout society, which is, of course, the whole point from the perspective of the central bank and the government, who has the power to initiate this process, right? It's a process of wealth transfer, as well as other aspects to it, but at least that. Now, how much money has been added in the last couple of years? Well, if you look from January 1920 to January 21, the M1 money supply, calculated in the new way, went up 24%.
Wait, did you mean to say 1920 or did you mean to say 20?
I'm sorry. I said 1920. I meant 2020.
Okay. Because I know that we've written on the period of 1920 to 21.
Wait a minute. Yeah. Sorry about that. Yeah. So in that year, that 12-month period, the M1 money supply went up 24%. And from 21 to 22, it went up another 15%. So we do have a rough aggregate sense of how much the money supply has gone up in the last 2 years. We can look at the precise, you know, monetary figures. They went from something like 16 trillion, 15 and a half trillion to 20.7 trillion. So this is, you know, almost $6 trillion of new money. Now, when we say money, of course, it's currency plus claims to money. So just checking account claims to money. Now, where did that all go? Well, yeah, that's a little bit harder to parse out. If we had sufficient data collection, and maybe in the future, we would have sufficient data to know better. But we do know that the Fed's part of this, the Fed has expanded its balance sheet from, again, if we go, say, February 2020 to February 21, their balance sheet increased some $3.4 trillion. And a large portion of that was used to simply buy treasury debt and mortgage-backed securities. So a large part of the funding went directly to the treasury. They were the first receivers of the money. If you look at the period from February 2020 to February 2022, the increase is $4.7 trillion. So of the $6 trillion or so in increased money, $4.7 trillion went directly to the treasury from the Fed. And then, you know, we can also trace some went to banks, obviously, because the Fed is buying some of these securities from banks. And so you can trace out that effect, right? Then what do the banks do with the money? You would have to trace out the commercial loans and their loaning portfolios and so on. And you could get a kind of rough sense of where the first steps are in this process.
All right. There are a few quickie-ish questions that I'd like to get to. So I'm going to go out of order again. News is fake. Social media is censored. What reassurance do I have that today's economics can be trusted? I would say today's economics probably can't be trusted. That's why we support the economics of yesterday, which is Austrian economics. It's exactly the reason. I mean, it's almost, Jeff, like the profession has become a racket of just useless reams of nothingness. I mean, I know there are decent people who, you know, are probably doing some good work out there, but Jesus, it's become impenetrable. And then the woke stuff is creeping in. So that's exactly why present company accepted. You might say the only good economist is a dead economist.
Yeah, it's really shocking. And I know Peter Klein's done some really good assessment of all this, right?
Yeah.
Where
he
talks about how even the economists who aren't sort of taken by lefty ideology, the whole profession has sort of driven them to degenerate into these little, like Dr. Klein calls them, these little toy economies. They're really just talking about these very specific data sets, and they play around with them, and they, you know, it's a very little consequence. What they're finding out about correlations of data sets is really not the pressing issue of the day, let's put it that way. And so they leave these big questions of the day, you know, what kind of political system should we have, or what should we do about central banks, or, you know, what would be the economic effect of decentralizing political power? You know, these big questions, they leave to non-economists, or again, to economists like Paul Krugman, who will talk about these big issues. And I'm not speaking now about Austrians. We, of course, also talk about these big issues, but the profession is just a complete mess.
I'm going to put in the chat a link to an episode of the Tom Wood Show I did with Peter on this exact issue of the problems with current day economics. So, all right. Another one. It is argued that the so-called robber barons were free market advocates and brought much value for which they were not credited. However, they used bribery, price cutting below cost, and congressional favoritism and pressure to achieve their ends. To me, this doesn't sound like laissez-faire capitalism. What are your thoughts? Well, I'll jump in here and then you can jump in.
Sure.
Jeff. I mean, the classic book on this, as Jeff, you know, is Bert Folsom's book, The Myth of the Robber Barons, where he disentangles different people. He says you can't make a blanket statement one way or the other. They were good or they were bad. Some were good and some were bad. You know, I mean, that's the way life is. So he says, yeah, there were some who they advocated for tariffs or whatever, and we have to be critical of that. But that's not true of all of them. And so he goes through and actually chronicles some of them and shows the way some individual actors really almost single-handedly helped to put downward pressure on the prices of extremely important products that had widespread effects throughout the economy and on the standard of living, on the general standard of living. It's quite astonishing what they accomplished. You have Tom DiLorenzo's famous article, well, to me, famous article in the International Review of Law and Economics, where he actually went through and looked at the various industries that were accused of being monopolized. And he looked and said, all right, well, let's look and see. Let's look at where prices were going in these industries. Where is output going in these industries? And it's just the opposite of what you would expect if they were, quote unquote, monopolized. So some of this is propaganda. You should read Bert Folsom's book, F-O-L-S-O-M. But also, first of all, since Congress itself is not a free market institution, there's no clear free market way to interact with it. So I personally think if you bribed a congressman to lower a regulation, I don't see that that's necessarily a moral wrong, right? The regulation is an evil initiation of force. So if I use a peaceful way to try to minimize it, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But obviously, if I'm using bribery to get some special advantage for myself that doesn't go to other people, that's a different story. But then also, I don't see what's wrong with price cutting below cost, quote unquote. I mean, for one thing, like what would be wrong with that? Can't I just set a price wherever I want to set it? And if the idea is that, oh, but then you just drive your competitors out and once they're gone, you'll raise your prices way up again, that's the phantom of predatory pricing. And the problem there is you find almost no examples of this in real life, basically no examples of that happening. I know we can all think of companies that lower their prices very low. And so you feel like there's a counterexample. But when do they then shoot them way up to try to get quote unquote monopoly profits? It's a suicidal strategy. Because you would have to keep taking these losses against every single competitor who comes into the market against you. I wrote about this in my book, The Church and the Market. It's a suicidal strategy, which is why you can't find examples of it, because most businesses would listen to you describing it and say, why would I ever want to try that? It wouldn't work for me. But can you, as an economist, Jeff, can you say a little something about, quote unquote, price cutting below cost and what if that's meaningful or not in terms of how Austrians think of cost?
Right. Yeah. Austrians think of cost, of course, as opportunity cost. And so in different situations that an entrepreneur faces in making a decision about what to do, you would have to consider the cost with respect to the alternative that's available to the entrepreneur at that moment. So to take a couple of cases of this, let's suppose we have an entrepreneur who hasn't yet produced a good and he's thinking about costs. He's thinking about the future, how this is going to play out in the future when he incurs costs to buy inputs. And then, you know, after that, he would have the good produced and he'd offer it for sale. And then he would hope to sell it at a price that would cover his costs. So production costs would enter into his decision at that point because he hasn't incurred them yet. They can be avoided by him deciding to produce in a different line of production and not buy these inputs. But once he's bought the input and produced the good, then whether he sells it at one price or another price doesn't depend upon these costs anymore. Once he's incurred the cost, then he's going to sell the product for the best price he can fetch. This was, again, the point that Rothbard was making that we mentioned with the monopoly case, Rothbard and Mises on monopoly. There, the opportunity cost for the entrepreneur, once his production costs are incurred, the opportunity cost is he can sell it to someone today at the price that this person's willing to pay, or he can hold on to the good and attempt to sell it to someone else at a higher price or a better price sometime in the future. You know, when he gets to that point, for him to sell at a price below cost, his production costs, is just not, it's not relevant. It may be relevant to whether he produces any more in that line, but it's not relevant to his decision to sell. His best decision at that point is just to sell at the best price he thinks he can get in the soonest time frame at which he could sell the good. And so it's really important to associate both revenues and costs, or value and costs, with the actual real situation of acting of real people, and not to think of them in a too abstract or formulaic way.
Hey folks, as part of my sponsor message for BitTrust IRA, let me tell you what I gave two of my daughters for Christmas this year. I gave each of them 1/100th of a Bitcoin. Now, if you don't know about Bitcoin, that might not sound like a lot, but these days it kind of is. And I thought that giving them a stake in Bitcoin would be a great way to introduce them to it. And of course, a lot of people have become very interested in Bitcoin, especially over the past several years, and they know they should hold it, but the cryptocurrency world can be confusing. Well, one thing a lot of people have been doing is adding Bitcoin to their retirement accounts. And BitTrust IRA helps you seamlessly and securely add cryptocurrency to your portfolio. BitTrust IRA stores your private keys in nuclear bunkers with military-grade encryption. Plus, they have a 24/7 trading platform with no minimum investments and unlimited trades, plus a team to help guide you along the way if you have any questions. They also offer the lowest trading fees in the industry. Go to bittrustira.com/woods today to learn more. And for a limited time, BitTrust IRA is waiving the sign-up fee for Tom Woods Show listeners. That's a $50 value. That's bittrustira.com/woods. BitTrustIRA.com/woods.
Let's see. How about, oh boy, that's a really technical one. Oh, how about this one? Do you have any book recommendations for how Austrian economics can be applied to financial advising? I mean, there is that Tao of Capital book by Spitznagel, I guess, but I don't know much about it.
Right. What's the name of the book? I'm going to forget this now. It's a book on value investing.
I'd actually have value investing in the title.
Yeah. And the author's name starts with a C, but I'm sorry, I'm just not remembering it.
Okay.
You know, quite a bit of this is emerging in the literature now, in the journal literature, and it isn't so much yet in book form about an Austrian approach to financial advising. So you find some of this in the work of, let's say, David Rapp, who's a PhD in auditing, and he's done a lot of work on the subjective value theory of pricing of assets, how this should be done by those who wish to make financial investments in assets. So it is true that there isn't a lot of accessible book treatments of this whole field. That's kind of a gap in the Austrian literature that needs to be filled, but it is building. And so there are some works that you can find.
All right, let's see. Mark Skousen has a book called A Viennese Waltz Down Wall Street that looks at it also.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's see. Professor Herbner, I'm currently planning on studying political philosophy in graduate school. I was curious if you had any recommendations as to economic books on, quote, spontaneous order or social ordering. I know that Rothbard discusses it in The Ethics of Liberty with regard to mutually advantageous trade. Hayek says much the same in Law, Legislation, and Liberty, albeit more confusingly. Are there any other resources you would recommend discussing how social ordering can come about without a government?
Yeah, I think the work of Hans Hoppe that we've mentioned a couple times tonight is very helpful in this regard.
I have another one before I forget, because that's going to escape me. Ed Stringham has a book called Private Governance, Creating Order in Economic and Social Life. And I think he talks about the stock market maybe it's the Dutch stock market.
Amsterdam. That's right.
Yeah. And a bunch of things that come about. And that was published by Cambridge. Mm-hmm. So I would recommend that as something. Okay, now go ahead. Sorry.
And what's the Benson book?
Oh, yeah. There's The Enterprise of Law.
Enterprise of Law.
Yeah.
Seems like there's something else.
Well, there's the edited volume by Stringham called Anarchy and the Law.
That's right.
So that's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
Doggone it. I feel like there's one other such book. But anyway, but that'll get you started. Certainly, that'll get you thinking the right way about this stuff. Okay, let's scroll down. Okay, Do you think that what we're seeing with price inflation portends a repeat of the 1970s? And if so, what can be done to mitigate this? Now, incidentally, I was just talking with Joanne Skousen about this because somebody was asking, I know a lot of people recommend having an emergency fund in cash of 6 months worth of expenses to have try to save up that as an emergency fund. But what do I do to keep my emergency fund from being eroded when inflation is, you know, increasing at this rate? And one of the things she suggested is, well, think about one of the things in your 6 months of expenses is going to be food, right? I mean, you know you need food. So why not go to places where, you know, it could be a local farmer with a cow, or it could be Costco or whatever, go and stock up on a lot of food. Yeah. And thereby you get real goods right away. And that's one way to help protect against inflation.
Yeah. No, this is absolutely right. You need to be in real goods. My wife and I have done precisely what Dr. Woods was just talking about. So we bought
a cow?
We bought a side of beef.
Did you really?
Butchered side of beef, sure.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And we have this really free enterprise farming community in central PA. We bought a whole, you don't call it a side of pork, but it was like half of a pig butchered just last month. And this meat will, of course, we'll be eating this meat, well, I would say for at least a year. So we've got a free.
How did you find it? How did you just happen to know? Or is there a website?
Yeah. Well, there's a website for this farm. It's called Family Cow. And they're Pennsylvania specific. They deliver by van to various places in Pennsylvania, maybe Ohio as well. I don't think they'd travel all the way to Florida, Tom.
But there's got to be one around here, right?
Oh, sure. Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. This is springing up all over the place. And so that's the sort of thing you need to think about. If it's really going to be like the 1970s, it would be very prudent to invest in real physical things, land, you know, food, durable things.
Yeah. It makes sense. I mean, there's no arguing with the logic of it. Okay. Let's scroll back down. My goodness, we are accomplishing so many of these. Frank asks, wouldn't the arguments for, quote, the greater good be based upon some concept of welfare economics?
Yeah, I think this is what I was mentioning before. Well, the place where you most often have any reference to welfare economics are these sort of vague, you know, this has to be done for the common good assertions. And in a sense, this really isn't welfare economics. This is not technical welfare economics that we were discussing before with Rothbard and Hoppe's contributions. But you're right, they're tempting to answer the same kind of question. They just aren't doing it in what Rothbard would consider a scientific way. We hear this kind of language all the time, right? The common good, the government officials are working for the public good, you know, or as Frank puts it, the greater good. But this notion, you can't use it analytically. So if somebody just says, well, it's my idea that this is for the greater good and this is why I think this, then you can't settle any sort of debate with respect to their claim unless you agree with all of their presuppositions and so on. They can't convince other people who would take a different position. But at least the idea would be that with the scientific analysis, you can in fact settle a debate. So this is the this is the point that Rothbard was trying to stress, right? We need to take this whole question out of the realm of just subjective opinion or non-objective analysis, at least, and put it into a realm where we can have an objective treatment of the question.
I like John's question. When the COVID panic began, I thought, guided by my understanding of Austrian capital theory, that lockdowns would cause much more harm to the overall structure of production than they actually ended up causing. Where was I wrong? Is the actual structure of production in real economies much less fragile than I expected? Or were lockdowns not really as big as government wanted them to be?
You know, that's a really good question. And I think the answer, I haven't thought carefully about this, but I think the answer would be at least partially a question of expectations. I'm an entrepreneur, let's say, in the auto industry. And during lockdowns, auto demand collapses. And, you know, there are all these ongoing transportation problems with me getting inventory and so on and so forth. If I think this is only going to go on for a couple of years and the ship will right itself, you know, 3 years from now, I'm not inclined to disinvest. And other outside investors can hold a similar kind of expectation. They're not really inclined to massively disinvest in these fixed assets unless they think, look, the lockdowns are going to simply not allow a restoration of any sort of normal use of these assets. You think about the collapse of small restaurants, but even there, presumably the buildings would still maintain their, you know, the leased area where they're running their business would still maintain its capital value. You might see, you know, if you looked at the data specifically, you might actually see collapses in specific equipment that's used in small restaurants, ovens or, you know, implements that they use and so on. But it isn't beyond reasonable to think that as long as the expectation is that recovery will occur in these industries, maybe not fully, but, you know, adequately in a couple of years, that you wouldn't see a collapse, an immediate collapse or a, you know, a collapse that would be of similar size that people have the expectation that this industry is finished and it will come back.
Okay, let's see. We got a little bit of time. Okay, Jeff, you're a Hoppian. Can you explain why the welfare state demolishes the family and leads to civilizational decline? Let me just say, I don't think it demolishes the family. Because, I mean, just think about your own family. You wouldn't say, we have to all go our separate ways now because we can get a government check. It doesn't. So I wouldn't go overboard. But it undermines the family, yes. And Alan Carlson has, A-L-L-A-N, Alan Carlson has an interesting paper from years ago about the Swedish welfare state and its effect on the family, even in its early form, when it appeared to be almost entirely benign, the kinds of interventions that they had. But the thing is, every time the state supplants some private function, you know, providing for people in their old age, whatever, you're undermining a family function. And so I don't need to reconcile with my children. I can keep them at arm's length because I don't need them anymore. On the margin, it affects the kinds of decisions you make about when, in fact, whether to have children or not. And it's not even necessarily like you sit down and every decision you make, you calculate out the economic consequences. It's just part of the background of your thought in formulating your value scale. So that's described in that. In fact, I'll try and dig that up, Jeff, if you want to say it there, I'll dig up that paper.
No, that's a great work. Yeah, I would say the other thing here on Hoppe's view of the civilizational decline, his basic point, the economic point about this is that as the state increases its intervention into the economy, since their decisions are driven by shorter time horizons than they would be under monarchy or under some more sort of a systematic transition of personnel in the state, we see them, the government itself, engaging in policies that also reward short-term thinking on the part of non-state actors. So they give, you know, subsidies or, as Tom was explaining, they subsidize certain more immediate gratification consumption on the part of people at large. Then you start to see the capital consumption. You start to see the economic structure on which modern civilization is built. It begins to be decayed, right? It starts to, people start to eat away at the ground of it. And eventually then, if this goes on long enough or to a great enough extent, all of modern civilization then would in fact collapse as we know it. Now, as again, as Tom pointed out, that doesn't mean that culturally it all, you know, it's completely smashed, but it is possible. I mean, we see this kind of infiltration at a cultural level, this corruption of what was once a long time horizon culture, a delayed gratification. It was kind of infused in the culture, a sacrificial kind of culture, that this can be eroded. And over time, you know, the civilization that we have, at least, cannot be supported without longer time horizons and without intergenerational sacrifices that people make for their families and church congregations and loved ones and so on.
Let me answer Kevin's funny question. He says, Tom, I got here 15 minutes late. Did George Reisman get demoted? His book, Capitalism, is usually visible on the shelf behind you. I love that people know me so well that they recognize the book titles. And by the way, I'm going to show you now. Notice that the camera has not been turned off at any time. So this is not a trick in this entire session, but I'm going to show you where it is.
It's right here.
And the reason it's right here, I'd love to say it was because I was referring to it, but because the other day I was doing a session like this and I wanted to prop up the computer. So I used this to prop it up. That's why it's not there.
The okay, let's do
Bob's question. Professor Herbner, what do you think of Milton Friedman's support for universal basic income? I have a hard time justifying it with the rest of his positions. Now, did he believe, what's the difference between the negative income tax and universal basic income? Or what is the relationship between those?
Yeah, that's right. Friedman's idea was the negative income tax. So this isn't really universal basic income.
I mean, Hayek seemed to believe in a universal basic income.
Yeah, right.
He says that in The Road to Serfdom.
That's right. Yeah, I don't think Friedman necessarily would endorse UBI, especially in its sort of current configuration. His idea was that you want to minimize the disincentive that's created when people go on the dole, and the negative income tax is his attempt to, minimize that disincentive. And UBI, of course, attempts to eliminate it altogether by just paying everybody the same amount, right? Whether you're rich or poor or middle class, you get the same guaranteed basic income. Friedman didn't go that far. And so I'm not sure it's quite right to say that he supported UBI. On the other hand, he did support negative income tax. And so that is kind of an interesting gateway into Friedman's other more fundamental deviations from, let's say, Rothbardian libertarianism, or even Mises's classical liberal position of the night watchman state. Should the government really have a sizable income tax structure from which they take, a fairly large proportion of income from taxpayers, only then does this issue of the disincentive of all that come up, right? If you had a tax system that was only taking 0.5% of income, this whole issue would be largely moot, at least in a practical sense.
Lily asks this question. Why is socialism, and I think we'll wrap up after this one. Why is socialism so appealing to some people? I don't understand why people agree with this. I want to try and take a crack at this. Sometimes it's that they lack perspective. They look around and see poverty, and they think that's capitalism's fault. Instead of looking around at wealth and saying that's the benefit of capitalism, and not realizing how much worse poverty used to be, and just having a very limited horizon of time that they're examining. But then the other thing is, it is based in part on envy. I remember reading an article, it was either about or by someone who worked for Amazon and lived out of her car in a parking lot. And she resented the heck out of Amazon. She said, "Look at Jeff Bezos eating his fancy steak dinners, and I'm stuck in my car." Now, no matter what Jeff Bezos eats for dinner, that does not affect her situation at all. And if it was somebody on earth who thought she was more valuable than he did, that person would have hired her for more. So literally no one else on earth thinks that her services are worth more than Jeff Bezos thinks they are. So the one person on earth who is improving her material condition is the person she's most angry at. Now, that's something wrong with that. And secondly, you may not make a princely sum working for Amazon, but you're earning more than, this is not even debatable, 99.9% of people who ever lived on the face of the earth. You have a standard of living better than 99.9% of the people who ever lived on the face of the earth. And your response to that is to be angry that the person who made it possible for you to have that standard of living has a higher standard of living than you. And not to mention, Amazon is, I get they have problems. Okay. I already know there are books that they won't run. And I understand that. But that's beside the point. That's not what Bernie Sanders is upset about with Amazon, okay? I mean, I love all the libertarian nitpicking of Amazon. There's a place for it. But that is not the reason Bernie Sanders doesn't like it. Okay, that he loses no sleep over Amazon banning books. He just doesn't like there's a rich guy and a bunch of not-so-rich people. But we think about Amazon is helping to bring together all these products of the International Division of Labor. And so when I think about the benefits that I get from the mere existence of a billionaire or a bunch of billionaires who invest capital in various projects. Here's the benefit. The benefit is, imagine, as indeed someone who did a TED talk once tried to do, imagine if you tried to build a toaster on your own. And I mean entirely on your own. I don't mean just go get the parts from Home Depot and screw them together. I mean, go figure out how to mine the metals and flatten them. And then I want you to go figure out how to assemble a spring mechanism. And then I want you to learn electricity and how to make a plug and plug it into the wall. I want you to do that. Now, think of how long that would take you. Your whole life, maybe? And then you plug it in, the thing lights on fire, probably. Or you could work for Jeff Bezos for 1 hour and get the money to buy that toaster. That's the benefit of a billionaire to you. Okay, that's astonishing. And that could be duplicated for every single product you buy. But because you have to buy the product, you feel like that guy is exploiting you. Well, if you had had to make that product, it would have taken your entire life. Or if you think of all the costs associated with it, they would have been astronomical. And you, in effect, have to pay, compared to that, you have to pay zero. And if you don't even stop to marvel at how astonishing that is, then I'm just going to say it, you're a bad person. And unfortunately, in our schools, we're not taught to think of it this way. I bet some people even listening to this presentation right now never thought of it that way. We're not taught to think that way. We're taught to learn how a bill becomes a law. Like, that's the fundamental principle of society. Instead of production and exchange. There, I think that, but that's, I think, where the appeal comes from, is that people feel like, yeah, that person in the parking lot should stick it to Jeff Bezos. But that is the absolute upside down way to think about it. I went a little over. Do you want to add to that, Jeff?
No, that was magnificent. That's exactly right, I think.
Thanks. All right. Well, with that, we are a little bit, you got a free few minutes, everybody, a free extra few minutes. So my thanks to Jeff Herbener. I'll look on the schedule and see who's due for next time. So I'll be sending you an email about that. But first of all, also thank you to everybody who, you know, I know you're busy during the week and you have a work day the next day and you've chosen to spend an evening with us. And I appreciate that. So thank you all. And thanks, Jeff. Always fun talking to you.
Thanks you, Tom. Thanks, everyone.
All right. Good night. All right, folks. LibertyClassroom.com is where to sign up. Awesome site. Many courses, like I think we have like 28 courses on a lot of different topics. You're going to enjoy them. Now, I want to mention what's going on tomorrow. If all goes well, I'm going to be at Scott Horton's house tonight. We're going to record the next episode of the Tom Woods Show, number 2087, at his house. So keep your fingers crossed that works out, because that'll be a lot of fun. Obviously, you have a sense of what the topic will be, but that is how we're doing it. So look forward to episode 2087, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.